Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 320. Welcome back. This week, we're going to continue on with the Swedenborg series from the Rosicrucian magazine. And we also have another piece from the Heretic Times entitled Rennes le Château, a Masonic Temple. And I also have another piece from the Midnight Freemasons. So stick around for this amazing episode. In the news this week, I need to say that I know in a previous episode I said I wasn't going to dive into this Franken manuscript, the 1783 Franken manuscript to be exact, and you know what, guys? I lied. It's a really good book. It's facsimile. It's very simply done. There's a few essays in the front which I skipped. What I really wanted to read was the rituals, and the rituals are there, and it's the degrees as they existed in 1783, which was the precursor to what eventually became the Order of the Royal Secret. The next thing to read after this, or to read side by side, as Brother Joseph Wages has stated, you read it with the Franken manuscript, which was published, I think, in 1790s, and that one's put out by the Southern jurisdiction and is done by Art de Hoyos. So reading them in succession or together is recommended, but it's so amazing to just get into this book and you just read a degree a day. It's outstanding. It's really cool. You learn some amazing things. Like, you know, there are people in our degrees that we just call whatever their title is, but they have names and you learn those names and stuff. It's really interesting. Check it out. But in the news regarding the book is not so much that book, but the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction, who has just released The Spirit of Freemasonry, which is based on some additional manuscripts that were published. So check that out. I think it's like $75 on the Northern Jurisdiction's website, and it's $10 to ship. It's 500 and some odd pages, so decent book. I'm assuming, I haven't checked it out yet. It is on my to-buy list right after I buy that Southern Jurisdiction 1790s Franken manuscript. I do want to check out those things side by side. And of course, eventually, I want to read that former document from which this all came. But more on that in the weeks to come when the book finally comes out. Check that out. It seems really cool. You can read about it on Chris Hodapp's blog, freemasonryfordummies.blogspot.com. I think it's the first article up, and it probably will be when this episode goes live. If you're listening and you're way in the future and this is a past episode, you want to look back at Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. With that, let's get right into the first piece, which we will also continue into the next episode, because this is, again, continued at the end of this reading. So here we go. Swedenborg and His Alleged Masonic Connections by J. Heindel, continued from May. There is a systematic silence in relation to Freemasonry in all the writings of Swedenborg. Not once is this subject even mentioned, and yet his whole theology is Freemasonry pure and simple, and can be summed up in two general doctrines conferred by his personal experience. First, the absolute truth of the existence of God, and second, the absolute truth of immortality. Swedenborg did not merely believe in God and the divine providence, he saw him face to face and the laws of his providence in actual operation. And he knew what he was writing about. This is clairvoyance, and something far different from blind faith in doctrines believed on the authority of others. It is the opening of a sixth sense through which a man actually feels his immortality with the same absolute certainty as he feels another object through the sense of touch. This sixth sense cannot be communicated from one person to another. It lies dormant in all. It must be developed through spiritual exercises, just as the ability to read and write is developed through special exercises. Through this sense, God and the facts of immortality are actually seen. God and immortality are the fundamental tenets of Freemasonry. Why then did Swedenborg never approve of Masonry as a system? Why did he not condemn it? He seems to have made up his mind to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent. With all kindness and brotherly love, it must be said that true Masonry is something far different from what it appears to be among the great mass of the brethren. The accepted definition of Masonry is that it is a system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. Dr. Albert Galatian Mackey, in the preface to his valuable work on the symbolism of Freemasonry, says, quote, The Freemason has no way of reaching any of the esoteric teachings of the order except through the medium of a legend or a symbol. End quote. This statement should be read twice. Masonry is a system of exoteric teaching, whereby the esoteric secrets of Masons in Freemasonry are veiled and also illustrated. The esoteric teachings in this reality of which the exoteric is the symbol. In other words, what is generally called Masonry is merely the room adjacent to the lodge, and not the lodge itself. It is the place of preparation for the candidate, and not the work behind the door. An idea of what that work is may be gained from the fact that the number of members counts for naught in the true lodge. There it makes no difference whether 30 or 3 members are elected within a century, for the hand of a single true Mason wields alone more power than the armies of whole nations combined. In the true lodge are conferred greater honors than any king, prince, potentate, or other dignitary can bestow. What sublime prince of the real secret, what invisible helper of the true holy empire, would exchange his knowledge and his right for the rank and title of an English noble or a Roman cardinal? The latter are clothed with vestments of royalty and priesthood. The true Mason goes through life clothed in a humble garb of a workman who is ever ready to serve the lowest outcast on the wayside. The priest and the king are made by others. The Mason is a Mason. He gives his alms in secret, not letting the left hand know what the right doeth. He is unknown to all except his own. He knows that worldly wealth and honor are as stubble compared with that wealth and honor which one may gain in a world, quote-unquote, where the moral needs of mighty empires are styled like baby lips upon the mother's breast, end quote. The first lesson of exoteric masonry seems to be that a mason needs no weapon, either offensive or defensive. Probably few of the brethren realize the greatness and sublimity of this lesson. Masonry needs no weapon. It is above and beyond anything that can offend it, and it has therefore no need to defend itself. It is beyond the reach of steel and tongue, of sword and pen, and its work is so sublime that kings and monarchs have exchanged the scepter for the trowel and their crown of jewels for the working tools of an entered apprentice. If those who in the goodness of their heart think it their duty to defend Masonry against the accusations of Catholic hierarchy or against the influence of corrupt politicians would only think of this lesson, they would never, never, to the eternal shame of their order, fall so low as to give an unfriendly answer to such inarticulate prayers for a glimpse of light in the dungeon of despair. They forget that they are Masons and not politicians. The true Mason looks at attacks, these arrows shot in the dark without a goal in sight, as a modern soldier with a high explosive in his hand would look at the stone knife of an ancient brother who came this way a few thousand years before him. There is nothing in the Catholic Church or in any other institution that can in the least offend Masonry. On the contrary, their very attacks prove their helpless ignorance and their greater need of help. Even the Pope has his station in the lodge, and he must stand there whether he likes it or not. The Roman Catholic Church has many things in common with the Universal Brotherhood of Humanity, and following the inevitable decree of invisible helpers, man will again join together what men have for a time put asunder. The Fatherhood of God and the Brotherhood of Men have no place for a single outcast. The Student of Freemasonry and the Catholicism, written by an authorized messenger of the Elder Brothers, is able to lift himself above the conflict that exists between the representatives of the two great institutions because he knows that they are both under the absolute control of the invisible leaders who guide us all. Why should these two institutions hate and persecute each other with pen and sword when they are both necessary to carry on the work of evolution? It is true, water and fire do not agree. But what would our earth be without water or without fire? Is there not room for them both? There is good in both of them. After the Great War, human beings will become less inclined to condemn one another on account of the errors and the passions of the past, and will work together more and more for their own good, as they find it here and now. The last numbers of the Masonic magazine The Builder contain the reply of the Grand Commander Albert Pike to the encyclical letter Humanum Genus by Pope Leo XIII, which letter was published in previous numbers. There is the representative of 2 million Masons accusing the Catholic hierarchy of having burned to death 34,656 men and women during the Inquisition from 1481 to 1783. Here is the representative of 200 million Catholics indirectly accusing the Masonic hierarchy of having destroyed the souls of 79,332 men and women together through their hatred of the church. Meanwhile, the recording angels are keeping the account, and the law of consequences will adjust all differences with absolute justice. This law ordains that each individual, each institution, each nation, each race must reap what it sows. The student of Rosicrucian philosophy will discriminate and observe events in their relation to their deeper causes. He will learn that under the divine providence there is absolutely nothing left to chance, and that in the end all things work for good. He seeks the good in all things, and therefore he is no more afraid of the thunders from the throne in the Vatican than he fears lightnings from the throne of the Superman. He sees the sun behind the clouds and knows that the storm will pass in due time. The candidate who keeps his eyes open can learn much from the Masonic ritual. He is taught how the human race, when in its poor and blind and absolutely helpless condition, can neither offend nor defend itself against the invisible powers, is led by the help of natural laws to the silent gate, where the reaper with a scythe demands the pass that all must give. There the candidate must wait until the clock of destiny strikes his solemn hour before he can join that innumerable caravan that moves to the mysterious realm where each shall take his chamber in the silent halls of death. There he meets the all-seeing eye, penetrating the innermost recesses of the human heart and all his thoughts, words, and acts which he has tried to conceal in a world where hypocrisy and deceit often parade his virtues, appear to the sight of all. For there is nothing secret that shall not be revealed. The immutable and unchangeable law of divine justice will see to it that he reaps what he has sown. Many a sharp instrument he feels, the real nature of which he cannot see, will be used to break off the rough and superfluous parts of earthly nature, for now he has ceased to be his own master. Again and again he is sent back to the world, and in each new life, a new and better instrument is used until the stone is ready for that spiritual building, that house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. True Masonry is a secret institution known only to the initiate who has passed the dweller on the threshold. The angel of death seals his lips forever, and eternal silence is only an answer he can give to all questions or friends and relatives left behind. The true initiate is dead to this world. He has returned to the lodge from whence he came, and the mysteries of life, love, and intelligence are kept inviolable within the repository of a faithful breast. The real secrets of a Mason are known only to himself, and that is the reason why Swedenborg failed to make himself known as a Mason. Only the Mason knows the brother Mason. He needs no grips or signs to show where he came from. He knows his brother afar off, in the dark as well as in the light, and he can communicate with him in a language so perfectly that hypocrisy and deceit are unknown. The true Mason has indeed a charmed life, but if you watch his charm closely, you will discover that it is no watch charm, and that he does not wear it where it can be watched. He has no desire to follow the Knights of Columbus, the SA, or the YMCA, or similar organizations in their good work. He appreciates the insight of the government in refusing to allow Masons to take part in any service that would place Masonry on the same level with public charities. Masonry is a secret institution, and not to be classed with the public charities through which it works. A Mason's charity is invisible, and any attempt to make it visible will lower it in its efficiency and in the estimation of mankind. If the lesson and the obligation of secrecy are not heeded in the lodge, they will be taught in public in such a manner that they cannot be misunderstood. To be continued. Well, there you have it. Some really interesting points of view there by Jay Heindel, especially his views on our charity work and what cannot be described and the attributes of a true Mason. I find myself feeling as though I was reading a stump speech. Very powerful words, inspiring words, in fact. I found them inspiring. Others may find them inflammatory, and that's okay. This program is meant to help us learn, and sometimes we get uncomfortable, and getting uncomfortable is okay. That's a sign of growth. So on with the next piece this week is a great piece, again, from thehereticmagazine.com, Rennes Le Chateau, A Masonic Temple, by Duncan Burden, published April 10, 2016. The famous Roslyn Chapel in Scotland has been described as Freemasonry in stone, with such features as its iconic and rare three pillars at the head of the church. Even in the few Masonic manuscripts that exist from the very early 18th century, there are references to Freemasonry being supported by three pillars, representing wisdom, strength, and beauty. As it is relatively rare to find three physical pillars at the altar end of a church, and even more rare to have each column being so particularly different in design, implying each pillar had an intentional and additional significant meaning, the assumption is taken that their presence at Roslyn is a visual representation of this classical Masonic expression. Yet, besides this focal element, the chapel also has other aspects to which a Masonic value has been attributed, such as images of heads that appear injured in fashion, similar to punishments found in craft ceremonies, and other images showing characters touching areas of the body that would be laid bare when passing through various rituals found in the fraternity. Then there is the enigmatic legend of the apprentice pillar, and how its sculptor was slain by his master through an act of jealousy, and the King of Terrors engraving a term still found in English rituals. Furthermore, of course, the chapel's very existence is linked to one of the most important Scottish Masonic families, the Sinclairs. Whether we accept these links as evidence or as creative parallels or just coincidences, the study of the building of the craft are linked, leaving individuals to draw their own conclusions over the possibilities and probability of these claims. As some readers may know, I am a believer that Freemasonry is the focal element of Rennes-le-Château mystery, and that its ultimate value is Masonic. I have written previously on the Masonic features I believe exist in the church of this famous remote village, of how infamous codes related to the legend also appear to highlight Masonry, and even how the rogue priest could have used the structure, mystery, and passion found in Freemasonry to find a method of making money, a market to sell to, and a method and reason to keep it all secret. Now, I sincerely appreciate that for many, the probability of these elements is considered remote. For some, this is because they do not fit with the general belief that the treasure of the enigma is either a royal grave, a divine legacy, or a lost relic, or a hoard of buried gold. For others, it is a simple fact that the mystery relates mostly to the story of the village's Catholic priest. It requires an acceptance that this important participant in the legend was involved with an organization whose membership is strictly and historically banned by the governing authority of his own faith, the Vatican. As such, this would seem an unlikely probability. But is it? In the story of Abbé Saunière, he is hardly presented as the model Catholic representative, let alone a priest. He apparently continued to offer Mass when his superiors had suspended him from office. He seemed to be more than slightly evasive when formally asked to explain his finances and apparent access to excessive funds. As such, would it really be impossible that he may also have had a Masonic connection? Indeed, this is highly speculative, but perhaps less so when it is noted that not only are there Catholic Masons worldwide, other French Catholic priests are known to have joined the fraternity. For example, in 2013, Father Pascal Vissen, a French Catholic priest, was announced to be a member of the Grand Orient of France, the oldest Masonic Grand Lodge in mainland Europe. He apparently became a Mason in 2001, 5 years after he was ordained as a priest. It was not until 2013 that his membership became known to his Catholic superiors, when his bishop was then forced to suspend the 43-year-old priest from duty. So we can see that it can happen, yet the question remains, did it? Why would a Catholic join Freemasonry? Well, like most people who join, they join out of interest. The nature of the interest may vary, but usually they discover through asking that Freemasonry is simply an organization offering a system of moral and charitable instruction, and not any alternative religious experience. In addition, the classically educated priest would quickly recognize that the system of education in Freemasonry is based on the same classical systems of the church, such as those of St. Augustine and Hugh de St. Victor, and the promotion of the seven liberal arts and sciences, together with the accepted Vatican stance on historical works such as Plato's Timaeus. With this being both explained to an educated individual and then experienced after joining, it is understandable why Catholics and their priests do become Freemasons. But again, this does not mean that Saunière was a Mason, and indeed, no evidence exists that proves he was. Although, as history shows, you do not need to be a Mason to actually profit from Freemasonry. How is this possible? Recently, I engaged in a project to review the earliest linguistic descriptions of Masonic ritual. Most modern Masons are aware that the strict rhetoric of the ceremonies performed today is only around 100 to 150 years old, and that the regimental structure of the present rituals is the result of the various styles and systems that existed prior to this more standardized uniformity. As it is known that the existing rituals are conjured from the older texts, many studies exist and continue to be carried out to go gather evidence of those early ceremonies to review their content and to try and formulate a possible thread of development. Unfortunately, there is little surviving documentation of these early ceremonies. It is so rare that some scholars believe that no actual formal ritual rhetoric existed, but rather experienced brothers knew what sort of thing had to be said, and simply performed what had to be shown to them. The other reason so little material exists is that virtually all that does exist appears to highlight the devotion to secrecy, and thus is assumed that early brethren adhered to this concept devoutly, by not writing material down or not allowing material to be written down. If a lodge did create written learning aids, they were offered with the instruction that they be burned after having been committed to memory. This devotion to the oaths of secrecy means very little material exists, especially from the mid-17th to the mid-18th centuries. Fortunately, just like today, the public, even between the 17th and 18th centuries, were curious about Freemasonry. Some people looked to profit from this interest, so published pamphlets that claimed to reveal the ceremonies of Freemasonry and sold them to the public. These pamphlets are known as exposures, and examples date from as early as 1723, and are now the focus of research for modern Masonic scholars. Indeed, as these pamphlets were produced purely for profit, their content could be considered dubious, as a buyer would have had only the author's word that these were genuine. However, as modern research continues, Masonic scholars have found different ways to which to distinguish the dubious papers from those that seem to relate to genuine Masonic ceremonies. This is through scholars noting how popular certain exposures were. For instance, were they reprinted? Another method has been to cross-reference when a popular pamphlet was released in a town and or city, and to ascertain whether it would be referred to in an official Masonic meeting or minute book, to see if the publication made an impact, and whether that impact was seen as a negative or a positive one. The minute books of the Premier Lodge of London record various publications and show that at times Masons were so concerned about the content of some exposures that they felt forced to change some parts of their ceremony and or to swiftly pass rulings to try and protect the craft. Another method of authenticating these historic pamphlets was to look at surviving copies, see where they were found, and if anything on them seemed to verify them. Now, for myself, I have been studying these documents for a particular project, but in doing so I found something that could be of interest to those interested in the Rennes-le-Château mystery. In 1744, several exposures of French Freemasonry were released in France. One in particular was so popular that it was recorded as being in print until at least 1747, with additional material. The author of this pamphlet is unknown, but its popularity is without question, and it was called The Perfect Mason. In Freemasonry, every Mason is specifically told what the secrets of the craft are, and that it is only the handshakes, passwords, and signs which denote how far a brother has passed through the craft. These are taken as prized secrets, and part of the agenda of these pamphlets was to reveal those secrets, offering the opportunity to the reader to pass themselves off as a real Mason. The perfect Mason, the author gives the word-by-word description of the ceremonies known to them, including the words they offer as being the secrets of Freemasonry. One of these words is not a word used in English Freemasonry, so to me, it stood out. It stood out for another reason. I had seen the word before. Magdala, the name given to the Saunier's costly tower, the Tower Magdala. This could be a creative coincidence, but in the Masonic ritual, when a secret word is given, it is attributed with a meaning, and that meaning is also given in the ceremony. The text that the ritual given in the Perfect Mason continues and follows this Masonic tradition, expressing what the word Magdala is intended to mean to the brother. This meaning is tower. Remember, this is not from the secret Masonic document, but from a public and popular document published in France from at least 1744 until 1747. This coincidence could be extended when reviewing the name Saunier gave to his other costly building project, the Villa Bethania. Bethany is the village just outside of Jerusalem where the tomb of Lazarus is said to be situated. The famous story of raising from the dead is a focal point of the Masonic ritual and the very name of Freemasons, Sons of the Widow. The only other building Saunier appeared to show a special interest in was his own church, which he had engraved with the motto Terribilis est locus iste, meaning this place is terrible. The quotation is from the Bible. When Jacob had a dream, he climbed the ladder to reach heaven, where he was awestruck by what he saw. Jacob's ladder has long been a part of Freemasonry and is still evident on the tracing board of an entered apprentice Freemason. Its relevance to Freemasonry can be traced clearly to the early 18th century and appears in various exposures, even in The Perfect Mason. Saunier did not have to be a Mason to access these terms to create his own sanctuary for Freemasonry at Rennes-le-Château. Instead, he would only need a copy of this, or another French exposure. He would have been aware that these were published purely for profit, and this would have given him both the idea and the vehicle as to how to make money himself from those passionate about the craft. I personally believe he knew more than offered by these pamphlets, but I believe he used the material to set the scene in the village to encourage benefactors to believe he could pass on what all master masons are told to find, that which was lost, the genuine secrets of a master mason, a prize a devout mason may be willing to pay to receive. Duncan Burden has been a Freemason for most of his life and is a member of various Masonic bodies such as the Royal and Select Master Masons and Operative Masons. He is also a member of various Masonic chivalric orders, including the Knight Templar and Knights of the Red Cross of Constantine. Born on the Norfolk coast, he now lives in Hertfordshire, England, and his blog can be found at humblemason.com. All right, now comes the part in the show where I ask you to support the show. This show is made possible by your contributions. So if you go to wcypodcast.com, you can hover over support the show. You click make a direct donation. You can either make a one-time donation or you can make a monthly contribution. Whether you're a contributor at $2 a month, a fellow at $5, or a producer at $10, it's all up to you and every little bit helps. Again, even if you make a one-time donation for $2, it really does help. We also have our limited edition shop where you can pick up our exclusive lapel pin, so head on over there. You can read all about it. We have it on a few different products, including money clips, tie bars, and cufflinks. We have our Mason's Lady car decal even. Those are in limited quantity, so if you want one, let me know. Order one up, because they don't last forever. I also have a great partnership with Onnit Labs. So if you click on the link, you can then click on the link to go to get some Alpha Brain or Hemp Force Protein. Either one of those products are great. But once you click through our links, do some shopping there and make sure you use the promo code WCY at checkout and you'll get 10% off your order. It's a great way to get something for yourself. It's a great way to support a good company that's all natural. And it's also a great way to support this show. So check that out. And we also have a great sponsor, Brother Levi Banker of Banker's Best. So go to wcypodcast.com, click on the links. That'll take you to buybankersbest.com. And you can get some really great beard oils and balms, all sorts of great stuff that he's got out there. And he's a brother right out of St. Louis. He was there when they read my petition at the Valley of St. Louis, in fact. So great guy. He even worked with a Masonic artist to come up with the artwork for the product. It's great. And again, if you use the promo code there, BBWCY357, 20% off. It's pretty killer. So check that out. And lastly, we have our WCY and Thrive account. That's how you support this show. That's how we continue week after week and bring you 320 episodes for free. And now we'll go into one last piece for this week from the Midnight Freemasons. Now, this piece is actually from a guest on the Midnight Freemasons. I've had the distinct pleasure of having a really unique dinner experience with his brother, Brother Robert Jackson. What an incredible guy, really knowledgeable, way smarter than me, but he's so caring and really poignant in his words about what he cares about and what Freemasonry is. So this piece is called A Master's Work by Midnight Freemason guest contributor, Worshipful Brother Robert Jackson. I've heard before that our job as Masons is to make more Masons. What does that mean? How do we successfully do that job? In one light, we can think that it's just the degree work. Open the doors, get them through, either through one-day classes or in the traditional method. But does simply taking a degree make a man a Mason? If you're reading this, I'm betting your answer is no. So how do we do our job? Much like fatherhood, there is no real instruction manual. What is the best way to make a Mason? I would argue that making a Mason has little to do with kneeling at the altar and taking an obligation. Funneling people through the machine doesn't make Masons. Churning the machine, however, does have an impact on the fraternity. The importance on the ritual can be diluted, and worse yet, the Masons supportive of the machine can burn out through a serial repetition of degree work. So, if our job is to make Masons, how else can we achieve this goal? Throughout our lives, we rarely have a comprehensive view of the full impact of our actions, either good or bad. Everything we do has an impact on others. Whether it's holding a door open for somebody, hanging with a friend while he's getting his first tattoo, or cutting somebody off in traffic. your action ripples, and at least partly determines what kind of day somebody is going to have. Beyond that, their actions from day to day could impact their life for years to come. Cue butterfly effect. Note that none of these scenarios required the recipient to be a brother. By being men of strong moral character, applying those working tools each day, we spread a positive opinion of the fraternity and the craft. A courteous and helpful hand, who just happens to be wearing a Masonic ring, could do more for our fraternity than all of the advertising campaigns combined. More importantly, however, we are able to distribute the compassion and care that our world seems to so desperately need. I would humbly submit that the best way to create Masons is simply by living the lessons of our craft, spreading the cement of brotherly love and affection. Robert E. Jackson. Robert Edward Jackson is a past and presiding master of Montgomery Lodge, located in Milford, Massachusetts. His Masonic lineage includes his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, a founding member of the Scarsdale Lodge 1094 in Scarsdale, New York. When not studying ritual, he's busy being a father to his three kids, a husband, Boy Scout leader, and a network engineer to pay for it all. He can be reached at info@montgomerylodge.org. Well, that's it for this week, everybody. I hope you enjoyed. I know I'm always enlightened by the material we get to read here. Spread the word. Share this show with your friends. Share it with your new brothers. Share it with your family who wants to know what Masonry is. We've got some great episodes back in the beginning that explain Freemasonry pretty well. If there's a particular episode you love, share it. Share it with your lodge. You can do all this cool stuff. If you have a lodge page and you want the podcast to be on your lodge page, let me know. I'll send you an embed code that'll always have the latest episode and a player on your lodge page or whatever you guys want. But in any case, I just want to thank you for listening and for coming back week after week. It's really been an absolute pleasure to bring you this stuff. And if you like Masonic podcasts, as I know you do since you're listening, go on and check out the Masonic Roundtable live most of the time. Every Tuesday night at 10/9 Central. And don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons, publishing 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Except for last week, we did Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. My fault. Check it out. We'll have some great content coming up. I've got a couple great pieces from Brother Scott Duvall coming up. I've got another great one from Bill Hosler coming up, which is going to be just fantastic. I know you will all enjoy. And we've got some more from Todd E. Kreese and 33rd Degree as well. With all that, I know you're probably masoned out for the day, and that's not a bad thing. So go change some lives, go change the world. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.